Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're going to talk with one of the authors of the book, Buried in the Sky, the extraordinary story of the Sherpa climbers on K2's deadliest day today. We'll also talk with doctor-treated survivors from that deadly day. We're talking about K2, the deadliest mountain on Earth. It's slightly shorter, not quite as tall as Everest, but has earned a reputation as the Savage Mountain. And this will tell you, in 2008 alone, the fatality rate of those leaving for a summit bid was 30% higher than casualty rate at Omaha Beach on D-Day. The deadly single disaster in K2's history occurred August 1st and 2nd, 2008. Within 27 hours, 11 climbers died. And this book tells the story, not from the perspective of Western climbers, but from the perspective of often overlooked high-altitude workers, Sherpa and Pakistani climbers, who scout the routes, tie the lines, and guide climbers through the heights of the death zone. And we're joined now by co-author of the book, Amanda Padawan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Appreciate you taking time to be with us. We're also joined by Dr. Eric Meyer, who was... on that one of those expeditions, decided not to go to the full summit and treated survivors as they came down on that deadly day. Dr. Meyer, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
I believe that we're talking to you both from Colorado. As I look at the itinerary, very full itinerary of book signings and events.
That's right. I'm in Vail, and Eric's in Steamboat.
Steamboat. Steamboat is your hometown.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yes. And both of you are coming to Salt Lake City. That's June 25th, 7 p.m. This is in conjunction with King's English Bookshop. This event will be at the Salt Lake City Public Library, 7 o'clock, as I mentioned. Amanda Padawan, Eric Meyer, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, Chiring Dorje?
That's correct.
He is one of the Sherpas who was on this. In fact, figures prominently in the book.
Yes, this is the intersecting biographies of Chiring and the man whose life he saved, Pasang Lama.
Yeah, that's tales of heroism up there on the slopes. We'll get into that. My first question for each of you, people who aren't into mountaineering, who don't climb these tallest mountains in the world, probably wonder why you do it. First, with Amanda Padawan, I understand you've been climbing all over this. What is the range called? Begins with a K.
The Karakoram. I've been climbing in the Himalayan, the Karakoram, since I was 14. And I guess the question is why do we climb? There's one school of thought that mountaineers who attempt K2 or other 8,000 meter peaks are just crazy or running away from something. I don't buy it. There's a lot more to climbing than that. When you climb a mountain, it's fundamentally, at least for me, an act of transcendence. And even if you don't have a belief in God on a mountain, your spirit will respond as if you do. You feel wonderment. For myself, I'm humbled by the beauty and sometimes the horror of these forces, this natural world that's still beyond our control.
I'm reading here from, or looking at Explorer's Web. You contribute to this website. It not only includes mountains, but oceans, polar regions, space, air, this all, the connecting thread through all of this would be what? Adventure,
exploration,
testing yourself?
Yes, I mean, exploration has an element of, a very important element of discovery and knowledge, pursuit of knowledge. So when you're doing these things, you need to bring something back, whether it's an artistic experience or something educational. So exploration certainly is different than adventure.
And Dr. Meyer, I understand you're a mountaineer as well.
That's correct. Yes.
So the same question. Why do you do it?
Well, for me, I think it's climbing big peaks, Himalayan peaks, is challenging on a lot of different levels. Personally, it's a huge physical challenge, but also I enjoy the professional aspects of practicing medicine in austere environments. And the physiology of high altitude medicine is something that I've been interested in for a long time, and enjoy seeing the effects of that and studying the effects of that in remote places.
And you, I've been reading in this book and other places, when you get it above a certain level, it's just very hard. People start hallucinating in some cases. The judgment goes down. You have to be very careful in those oxygen-deprived zones.
Well, that's true. Hypoxia or low oxygen in the blood affects everyone, but it does affect everyone in different ways. And some people are more adaptable to it. Certainly, the Sherpa population is remarkable in their ability to acclimatize or adjust to the low oxygen environment and be able to function at a very high physical level. That's something that's always fascinated me. We kind of joke about it as Westerners, though. In order to do well at altitude, you have to choose your parents carefully. So there's definitely a genetic aspect of being able to perform well at altitude, and that's something that I think is really fascinating.
In fact, Chöring Dorje had summited K2 without bottled oxygen before even this expedition in 2008. One of the few, I would imagine.
Actually, he did summit K2 in 2008 without oxygen, but that was his first attempt.
Oh, I see.
K2.
I see. Yeah. So back to Amanda Padawan. You profile in the book some of these men who aren't covered by the media as much. Chöring Dorje, who's the Sherpa, who's on that expedition. Pasang Lama, hope I'm saying that correctly, has a very interesting story. Shaheen Beg, who's a Pakistani. For men like this, are the reasons the same, do you think, as Westerners, and why they climb? Of course, part of it is an economic reason.
Yes, I mean, it's not easy money, but it's expedient. You can earn about six times as much as a farmer makes in a year, and make it within 6 weeks. That's quite a temptation. But the mountaineers and the high-altitude workers who I've interviewed are also affected by the beauty of the mountain, and it does become addictive. There are the financial incentives, but many of these climbers keep returning, even when they've earned enough money, because the peak keeps calling them back.
Mm. You write that, at least for some of these climbers, native climbers, there's a cultural or religious bias among some of their relatives and friends against this. You really shouldn't be doing this.
Yes, for the Tibetan Buddhists, this climbing to a summit is, to put it mildly, an act of blasphemy. When you climb a mountain, you're entering a sacred space that belongs to the resident deity. Everest has Myolo Sangma. K2 is actually believed to be the home of Takar Delsangma, the goddess of security. She has a green face and flies around the summit on a turquoise dragon. So this is an area that you should not violate. When you do climb, you are trespassing. So the goddess typically will punish you. If you're lucky enough, she won't. So mountaineers are looked down upon. At least historically, they were looked down upon in these traditional Tibetan Buddhist communities because you were climbing for money and you were violating the goddess's home.
Hmm. Has that changed over time, this bias against it?
Well, some of the interviews I did with the older generation, they appreciate the money that's brought in by mountaineering. But even with men like Chöring Dorje Sherpa, he prays to the goddess, permission to ascend her peak, and when something goes wrong, he attributes it to the wrath of the gods.
Hmm.
But K2 itself, there are many Pakistani high-altitude porters who have such a different perspective. K2 is merely a creation of Allah. It is rock and ice. There is there's no resident deity. Hmm. So that tension is always present between the high-altitude workers, those who are Muslim from Pakistan, and those who are typically Tibetan Buddhist from Nepal.
In the pictures in the book, you reproduce a letter that Chering Dorje's grandfather received from the British on an expedition that he went up. And you say that he didn't show this letter to his family. I guess that's part of it.
So this is the skeleton in the closet in Chering Dorje's family, that his grandfather was a great mountaineer, a high-altitude worker, who worked for, in 1955, ascended the sacred peak of Gauri Shankar in Rawaling. This is a very sacred peak to the Sherpas of the Rawaling Valley. Gauri Shankar has Tsiringma, the goddess of longevity, and it is a gross violation to climb that mountain. So he did it, and he was given this glowing recommendation letter, which he hid from his family and never talked about it. And Turing had family mementos and papers and discovered this only recently. So he does come from a tradition of mountaineers, but not a proud tradition, strangely enough.
We'll talk more about these very interesting men that you profile in the book, and it's a gripping story, even though we know the essential outline of the story. And Dr. Meyer, of course, was there. K2's Deadliest Day, it is a gripping story. Buried in the Sky, the extraordinary story of the Sherpa climbers on K2's Deadliest Day. That's August 1st and 2nd of 2008. That's the book. It's written by Amanda Padawan and Peter Zuckerman. And we have with us on the line from Colorado, a couple of different places in Colorado, Amanda Padawan and Dr. Eric Meyer. You're welcome to join this conversation if you have a question or comment. Certainly encourage that. 1-800-826-1495. 1-800-826-1495. Or you can email us at upraxis@gmail.com. upraxis@gmail.com. Coming up on the 25th of June at Salt Lake City Public Library. It's an author's live series with Amanda Padawan, Eric Meyer, and Chering Dorje. And that's at the Salt Lake City Public Library in association with King's English Bookshop. 7 o'clock on June 25th. It's part of the book tour for this book. As I mentioned, the number 1-800-826-1495, UPR or upraxis@gmail.com. I notice many of the spots on this book tour are in Colorado, Utah, Montana. In the West, is there more of an interest among people who live among mountains for this kind of a book?
Oh, I just picked my favorite places.
Oh, I see. Okay. Very good. And there are other places, Washington, D.C. and Boston and other places. Let me turn to Dr. Meyer. Tell me a bit about K2. It has a reputation as the Savage Mountain. Why is that?
Well, K2 has that reputation historically because of the technical challenge of climbing on K2, for one. It averages 45 degrees from top to bottom. If you look at a picture of K2, it's kind of like what a child would draw if you asked them to draw a mountain. You know, it's a very pyramidal type shape. It's very remote. It takes 8 days of walking just to get to base camp from where the road ends. So that creates a lot of logistical challenges in terms of getting equipment and climbers to the mountain, even. And in case of a medical emergency, that's a great distance to try to cover as well. The weather on K2 is extraordinarily challenging. It tends to be very unpredictable, unlike the Everest region that normally has a couple of weeks in May where the winds die down and the weather is suitable for summiting. K2 sometimes is not summitable for an entire year. Sometimes the winds never come down below about 60 or 80 miles an hour. And so it is a matter of, it's a real challenge to time a summit attempt on K2. To have the acclimatization necessary, the equipment, the supplies, the positioning on the mountain to be able to get to the top and get back down before the weather turns. So those are some of the things that make K2 extremely challenging and why it's only been ascended a couple hundred times versus Everest, which has been climbed several thousand times.
Understand this is the most glaciated place on Earth outside of the polar regions. That presents some dangers.
Yes, it does. It's a hugely glaciated region, and it was really impressive to see the recession of the glacier in the last 50 years since Dr. Charles Houston was there in 1953. There was a memorial built on the side of the glacier then that is now probably 100 feet. The glacier is now probably 100 feet below it.
And when reading an interview with the NPR at the time, the 2008, you were saying there was a concern at this time, August of 2008, that perhaps there were too many people attempting that summit at that time. Some 70 people, right?
Well, on the final summit push from Camp 4, which is right at 8,000 meters, there was approximately 26 climbers going for the top. There were certainly many more down lower on the mountain. But K2 is also unique in that the climbing gets more and more difficult the higher you go. And a very technical area called the Bottleneck Couloir is a steep and narrow ice chute. And as you can imagine, with many people trying to get up through a very technically challenging area like that, that there were delays and quite literally a bottleneck.
And you decided, I think, along with some of your fellows, not to attempt the summit. Why?
Well, we turned around right at the base of the bottleneck as the sun was coming up at about 8,200 meters. And our thought was really one of a gut reaction. It was wanting to go to the top, but realizing that we were at the back of the line and everyone that was going to the top was several hours behind schedule. And our thought was that even with perfect weather, which it seemed to be, we'd all be descending down in complete darkness through some extremely technical sections, and that the condition of the serac or towering ice formations above the bottleneck couloir were in such a condition that they were going to start coming down in the next 24 hours. There were definitely signs of that, and everything led us to say, you know, it's just not our day to summit. So we turned around at that point.
And in fact, that late, I guess, start point and then descent point is what caused a lot of the problems, right, or contributed to it.
Well, certainly, that was one of the things that contributed to the deaths. The collapse of the ice towers happened about 10 p.m. that night as groups were descending, and the falling ice essentially cut off the retreat path. It took down the fixed ropes that were strung up in the bottleneck couloir and made descending that area extremely treacherous and accounted for some of the deaths that occurred.
And this is just heartbreaking. Turn back to Mount Padua. In the pictures, you know, since early on in the book, we know the story in outline. There are pictures of family members of some of the men that didn't come down. There's a picture of I think this is a Norwegian couple just been married for a year.
Yes,
they were to go up and the husband didn't come down.
Yes, Rolf Bae, who was an extraordinary mountaineer, and married Cicely Skog, had taken on K2 as a sort of honeymoon. And Rolf was standing below the serac around 9 p.m. when they calved, and he was hit right head-on by that falling ice and was never found. So Cecilia had to descend knowing that her husband had been taken by the mountain.
Yeah.
She's an extraordinarily strong woman to be able to get down the peak, down climb without ropes after that kind of tragedy.
Have you talked to her since?
I met with her. She was very, very generous to speak with us.
Yeah. What are her feelings now?
I think the devastation will never go away when something like that occurs. But she has skied to the South Pole. She has done some amazing climbs since in honor of her husband.
Hmm. So she continues to explore.
She does.
Yeah. There's another picture, and again, these are ghosts in one sense. A French climber, Hugues Dubarred, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who in your book you say that he called his I think his wife or fiance, and said this will be the last one.
He said next year we'll be at the beach. This time next year, our family will be at the beach, and he died within a couple hours on the descent. He slipped, perhaps threw a crampon, and fell down the bottleneck.
Hmm.
When you see Chiring Dorje Sherpa's summit photo, wonderful photo, he's holding the Nepali flag, but to his left is a shadow on the ice. That shadow belongs to Jimmick Bote. He's another mountaineer who didn't make it down.
Mm.
His son was born 3 days before the summit, and he never got to speak with his wife, and he would never see his son.
Then you have pictures of family members of some of the Sherpas and native climbers who died as well. This is tragic and also a big economic impact to these families as well.
Yes, it was devastating emotionally and financially. The photograph that I find to be the most poignant is Dawasangmu Bote, who is the wife of Jumik, one of the high-altitude porters for the Korean team. She is holding her baby, the baby that was born 3 days before Jumik summited K2, on the bed of her room when I met her in Kathmandu. On the bed is a sleeping bag with the label Colon Sport. That's the bag that her husband used last night on K2. That's what was given to her. And Colon Sport was the Korean team's sponsor.
Hmm.
So every day she has to live with that. Those men were extraordinarily heroic. Big Pasang Bote, another high-altitude porter for the Korean team, went up into an avalanche zone to try to save 3 to 4 mountaineers and never made it back.
Mm.
There are so many stories that didn't make it off the mountain, which hence the title, Buried in the Sky. We're not talking about bodies. We're talking about heroism and stories that would have been buried along with the men who lived it.
We are going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to tell the rest of this story and get into the stories in the background of some of the men profiled in this book and the heroism of several of these people who did things that they didn't have to do and put their lives at risk, saving others up on that deadliest day on K2. We're talking with Amanda Padawan, who's co-author with Peter Zuckerman of Buried in the Sky, the extraordinary story of the Sherpa climbers on K2's deadliest day. We're also talking with Dr. Eric Meyer, who is a medical doctor from Colorado, who was there on that deadly day and treated some of the survivors as they came down. And we'll be talking about the culture of the Sherpas, customs, and more about this extraordinary story when we come back following this break.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by area-info.net, providing a social media outlet for personalized press releases, business news, and events and opinions. Information at area-info.net.
Utah writer Gina Wickwar.
Alas, our two sons are arriving imminently with their spouses and our grandkids. The plan is to take off for Jackson and Yellowstone and have a great road trip and a grand old time sighting geysers and mud pots, bison, elk, and with luck, a bear or two. My husband and I are really looking forward to this family adventure. However, there is a downside. Oh, I don't mean the noisy grandkids whooping and hollering and racing around the upstairs library like wildcats, or the wailing in the back seat of the van whining about each other's cooties. No, the grandkids are mostly older these days and are more civilized. They enjoy car trips and the more quiet activities like games and puzzles, books, and their iPods. No, they I can handle with ease. It's their fathers that will be my undoing. You see, it's this way. Once upon a time, we were a PC family. Oh, I don't mean we were politically correct, though I'm sure we tried. Rather, we owned and operated personal computers. Mainly, this came about because our younger son, Nat, went to work for Microsoft, so we all caught the PC bug as well. Gradually, however, things went awry. Our daughter went off to grad school where the only acceptable computer was a Mac. Pressure by his law firm was brought to bear on Chris, the elder son, to also use a Mac. Nat left Microsoft to do some computerish things on his own, and feeling he had to fit in with all the startup, entrepreneurial types, he too switched. Left standing athwart history were Vin and I. That didn't last long. Vin went over to the dark side about 3 years ago and is, I must report in all honesty, a happy man, which left me, alone amongst my family, as the sole user of a Windows-based PC. And my, oh my, what a hassle I get from everyone. Emails weekly saying, my PC is so yesterday, really so last century. How can I stand Windows? Aren't I frustrated that I can't do X, Y, or Z? To which I respond, leave me alone. I'm used to my ancient, 7 years old, computer. I know Windows backwards and forwards and can do many things with it, like formatting a book and preparing a spreadsheet with Excel. And even though the little gateway is a tad slow on occasion, it is a no quantity. I like it just fine. This coming week, however, I know there'll be a full frontal attack on me by the family battalion. I will hear nothing else but how retro I am using a PC, how much nicer my life would be if I'd only get a MacBook so I can lug it around and write while I'm doing the laundry. I will, of course, stand firm and refuse to do any such thing. Even if I win that fight, which I will, I face an even scarier battle. My two sons will be in my study for hours, adding Facebook or LinkedIn or some other useless program that I'll never use, but which will add unintelligible icons to my desktop. It will take me months to relearn email because they will have upgraded it, as they will have my Word templates, which will take me weeks resetting. All this makes me want so much to return to the days of yesteryear when we were left each other alone, computer-wise, that is. Sometimes family get-togethers are not what they're cracked up to be. Wish me luck. This is Gina Wickmore.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about the book, Buried in the Sky, the extraordinary story of the Sherpa climbers on K2's deadliest day. Authors are Peter Zuckerman and Amanda Padawan, and we're talking with Amanda Padawan on the program today. We're also joined by Eric Meyer, who's a medical doctor and who's a mountaineer as well, and was at least the base camp and had climbed a part of the K2 mountain on those fateful days of August 1st and 2nd, 2008, treated some of the survivors as they came down. We're talking about mountaineering, exploring, why people test themselves in this way. We're talking about culture and customs of the Sherpas, these stories that are not as often told. And I want to talk a bit now about some of the decisions that were made on that day. And first of all, a quote from the book. I turn to Amanda Padawan for this. Shaheen Beg, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He says, climbers die because they ignore a set turnaround time. And you can't think clearly in the death zone, I think referring to the oxygen-deprived zone. I believe he's talking about, he's telling a story about K3 or Broad Peak, when he did decide to turn around and not summit. This was the only story, understand, that his wife Conda would stay around and hear him tell. She'd leave the room if he told any other exploratory stories.
Right. Well, a turnaround time on a winter ascent in the Karakoram is different than a turnaround time during a summer climb. Only one peak has ever been climbed, Gasherbrum 2 last year. Broad Peak has never been summited in the winter time. We're talking about minus 40 below. you must turn around, otherwise you will freeze to death in the night. Winter ascents are the most hardcore you can imagine. I don't feel so strongly about turnaround times in the summer. I know that other climbers feel differently. I feel that if you are climbing without supplemental oxygen, you can be a little bit more lax in a turnaround time. If you are climbing with oxygen, you have a turnaround time to guide you so that you know when your oxygen system, when you will run out. If you run out of oxygen near the summit of K2, and Eric can probably describe better than I, you will have tremendous medical problems. You are not prepared to be up there without supplemental oxygen, and it's much easier to get cerebral edema, pulmonary edema, to become so exhausted you can't move. But if you're climbing without bottled oxygen, you have better sense of your limits. So I don't feel that the turnaround time is such a crucial issue on that climb in 2008, although Shaheen felt that turnaround times are so critical that they must be respected at all times.
Mm-hmm. What's your view, Dr. Meyer, the turnaround time? Was that part of the problem there on 2008?
Well, about half of the group was climbing on supplemental oxygen, and half was not. And I agree with Amanda in that when you are climbing on supplemental oxygen, you have to be much more strict about turnaround times. And you tend to move a little bit faster. And I think the turnaround time is something that's pretty important to have in your mind, because as you're in that low oxygen environment, your ability to think proactively really suffers. You know, so you really cannot think like a chess match like you could down at base camp. You have to think about you have to basically have thought about your decisions in advance to be able to make good decisions up at extreme altitudes. Oxygen certainly improves your ability to think. It also keeps you warmer and allows you to move more quickly. But as Amanda pointed out, if a person does run out of oxygen up above 8,000 meters, the chances of making it down alive are really dismal. The body tends to really crash after being on oxygen and having it taken away at that altitude.
By the way,
it's devastating.
By the way, while I'm thinking about it, I meant to mention this earlier while talking about mountaineering and K2 and Everest comes to mind. Utah's proud of a Utah resident, Apa Sherpa, who I believe holds the record for most successful summits of Everest, 21.
Okay.
So throw that out there since we're talking about mountaineering. I believe he moved his family to Utah to get his kids a good education. Let me turn to the story of that you recount in the book Amanda Padawan of heroism up there on the mountain. It's dark, and there's been some bad luck. The ropes, which normally would be there at the bottleneck or nearby, have been cut, perhaps by an avalanche. And one of these men, Pasang Lama, gives his axe, as I understand it, to another group to help them.
Wind Cheering found Pasang Lama on this perch above the bottleneck. He was missing his ice axe. Pasang had sacrificed his ice axe earlier that evening to create an anchor for a rope system that would allow his clients to descend safely in an area called the Snow Dome. He thought that he could descend without an axe because the fixed lines were in the bottleneck. He could rappel down safely. But when he reached the bottleneck, there were no ropes. The falling ice that had killed Ralph Ba had also torn out these ropes, and Pasang was stranded. And he was standing on a shoebox-sized ledge beneath these calving seracs when Cheering found him. And what would follow is one of the most difficult and selfless rescues in mountaineering history. To do what Cheering did in the bottleneck of K2, on the most lethal stretch of the world's most dangerous mountain. From the Western perspective, what Cheering did was suicidal. From the Tibetan Buddhist perspective, what Cheering did was necessary, because for him, self-preservation is not his highest calling. So he took a short length of rope and attached it to Pasang's harness. And even though Pasang protested and said that he did not want Shearing to help him, that the mountain was going to kill both of them, and he wanted the mountain to take only one of them. Shearing tied the rope to Pasang and prepared to down-climb the bottleneck with one axe between them. And he told Pasang, brother, if we die, we die together. And it was not an easy descent, because if Pasang slipped, and he would twice, it would peel Shearing off the slope, and he would have to self-arrest and check the fall of not just one man, but two. Hmm. It was extraordinary.
And in the middle of this, you've got refrigerator-sized and bigger pieces of ice coming by. If that hits you directly, you're gone, of course, but you just have to hope for the best.
Yes, and Pasang was hit on the head at one point by either a rock or a chunk of ice, and that is what caused him to slip, and he did pull Shearing down the mountain. They went down about 9 stories until Shearing was able to self-arrest, that is, check their fall with his ice axe. But there were moments where he was certain they would die.
Hmm. What did these two men say now?
Well, when I ask Shearing, what were you thinking at the time? Because another mountaineer, another Tibetan Buddhist, actually had passed Pasang by, had determined that to rescue Pasang under those conditions wasn't possible, and that he would have to descend. So it's not merely a Tibetan Buddhist perspective. So this is true heroism. There's something else at play. What was Shearing thinking at the time? He said that he was thinking of his family. He was thinking of his mother, who had died in childbirth. He was thinking about what it is to lose a life, and he wasn't going to let Pasang die if he could help it.
Hmm. Dr. Meyer, in mountaineering circles, this is an extreme decision that's occasioned, I guess, by up there in extreme conditions and putting yourself to the limit. Is this talked about, this type of decision that has to be made sometimes?
Really not talked about. It's something that, it exists as this very strong bond between teammates when it's fully realized that you would indeed lay down your life for your fellow climber, your teammate. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that to a certain extent has been lost in a lot of commercialized climbing, where a client pays an outfitter a bunch of money to get them to the top and to get them down safely, and there's been kind of an obscuration of this very strong brotherhood of the rope, as Charles Houston described it, and it's kind of sad. But when you see a circumstance like with Shearing Dorje and what he did, it really does remind you that there's a huge integrity and strength of character present in him when this happened. And it was a big reason why we invited, why I really felt strongly about having Shearing Dorje on our team. I think it's important to point out that Shearing Dorje was a regular member of our team. He was not an employee. The Sherpa climbers that were on the Korean team were, in fact, employed.
Hmm.
So there's a different, there's a difference in role there. Shearing was a very, very experienced, very senior Sherpa climber that is, truly one of the elite climbers of the world. Hmm. And we were fortunate to have him as a member of our team. He wanted very badly to climb K2. And told me that the summer before when he was in Colorado in Steamboat. And that this was, and it's pointed out in the book how this created a little tension between he and his wife as he made that decision to go to K2.
Hmm.
And I think that's something that is it's very, very unique with this book, that actually describes the interpersonal relationships of Sherpa, and how they, you know, how they roll that way. So I think that you know, the interviewing technique that Peter and Amanda use, allowing the Sherpas to tell their story and then translating the entire conversation, is very different than when you translate sentence by sentence. And so, something I think that's extremely unique about the book.
And the book is Buried in the Sky, the extraordinary story of the Sherpa climbers on K2's deadliest day. Authors are Peter Zuckerman and Amanda Padawan. We're talking with Amanda Padawan, along with Dr. Eric Meyer, who's a medical doctor from Colorado, who was there those fateful days and treated some of the survivors as they came down. He's a mountaineer himself. And you're welcome to join this conversation at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or email us at upraccess@gmail.com. And coming to Salt Lake City will be Amanda Padawan, Eric Meyer, and Shering Dorje, who we've been hearing about, featured prominently in the book. He'll be here live, as they say. This is a author's live series, and it'll be the Salt Lake City Public Library, 7 o'clock in the evening on June 25th. That's in Salt Lake City. We have about 10 minutes left in this conversation. You're welcome to join it at 1-800-826-1495 or upraccess@gmail.com. Amanda Padawan, I was touched reading the book, as Dr. Meyer said, the family members of these Sherpa climbers. And this quote jumped out at me. This is Kanda. She's Shaheen Beg's wife. And she says, these are ghost stories of living men. She just couldn't stand to hear her husband talk about this, I imagine, because it just makes her so nervous. She might lose her husband on one of these expeditions.
Yes, and he came very close to dying, in fact. And when Shimshaw was hit by the deaths of these two men, Karim Meharban, who was a dear friend of mine, and the second man, Jehan Beg, it was devastating for the families, as expected. But most of all for the children. When I went to Shimshaw to spend time with Karim's family and conduct interviews, his four-year-old son was talking to me about the mountain, and he didn't realize that his father had died. He told me that his father was coming back from K2. It was a misunderstanding that he was still on the mountain and he would be coming home. The children get very distracted in school, even during normal climbing seasons. The effect on the families is tremendous. Even when no one dies, there's that sense of instability that they don't know whether a father is going to come back this time.
What's the typical average journey then, a life journey? I guess young men would come to Kathmandu, and from there they would become a porter, get into this business. So what would happen?
Well, in Chiring's life, he went to Kathmandu at the age of 14 to work as a low-altitude porter carrying loads for expeditions to base camps. And by the time he was 16, he was on Everest. And 12 Everest expeditions later, he came to K2 as a full team member. So that's the progression of the career, is that you start with these very humble first jobs, $2 or $3 a day, carrying 70 pounds of gear to these base camps. And then you work your way up to being a high-altitude worker on the summit team.
And the money's a lot better than a lot of other jobs.
Yes, and that's the temptation, because you are risking the wrath of the gods. It's not merely life and death. It's life, death, and afterlife, the decisions you're making up there. The goddess is watching you and can be displeased. So it's a tremendously dangerous job. It's also spiritually an offensive job, and the money is very tempting, that you can support your family within 6 weeks. Many high-altitude workers make that decision, that they will do that. And this is during a time when unemployment in Nepal was about 50%. During the civil war in Nepal, it was so hard to find a job, but Western mountaineers kept climbing. during the period of the Civil War, and those were the jobs that were available. Pasang Lama, the Bote high altitude worker who Chiring saved on K2, he never expected to become a climber, but when Civil War came to his little village in the Upper Aran Valley, and the Maoists took over the village and the king's army were shooting men Pasang's age, his parents made the decision to trek all the way to Kathmandu with absolutely nothing but what they could carry on their backs. And they lived in a room, seven of the family members in a small room. And that's how Pasang became a mountaineer, because his destiny was to become a potato farmer in the Upper Aran Valley in the shadow of Makalu. But he ended up on K2.
So is this exploitation, do you think, then?
No, but certainly conditions can be improved. Better gear, better insurance in case of loss of life. There could be much better work conditions.
Let me ask turn this to both of you, starting with Dr. Meyer. What are relationships like, then, between the Western climbers and the and the Sherpas? I guess it could range from colleague to employee, good relationships, bad relationships. What's the relationship like?
Well, I think like with any relationships, I mean, it can be, take all sorts of forms. I happen to have been lucky to meet Tsering Dorje in 2004 on Everest. We were actually on different expeditions. But we were sharing a common base camp, and I immediately became friends with him. It's just there's this common bond of the mountains, but it goes much deeper in terms of life values, sense of humor. I found Tsering to be just one of the most energetic, good-humored persons that I've ever met in the mountains, and invited him to come to Colorado, which he did, and he's just been a fast friend ever since, and a great climbing partner.
Amanda Padawan, go ahead.
Yeah, but he also is he guides climbers on Everest and other 8,000 meter peaks as part of his company, and has a very successful record of safety in the mountains. So I have a tremendous amount of respect for him.
Amanda Padawan, you write in the book the Tsering Dorje doesn't take caffeine. He doesn't need it. He's a very lively person.
He's a very energetic man. You have to be to stand on the summit of various 8,000-meter peaks 40 times. He's summited Everest 12 times. He's a superhero. Superheroes don't need caffeine, right?
Tell us a bit about Pasang Lama. What's he like?
Pasang has survived a civil war. He lived through the experience of being a refugee. Even going further back, he lived in a single-parent household. His mother was a single mom because his father was a mountaineer. His father was leaving each year to climb Everest and K2, and his father was gone for most of the year because of these mountaineering expeditions. The reason he did it, at least what he told me, is that so his sons would never have to climb a mountain. And it turned out that Pasang would go on to climb all the mountains that his father did. In fact, last year, Pasang's father was on the summit of Everest. These are family professions, and they really do affect families, that you don't have a parent. Even if the father isn't dying, he's gone all the time with these expeditions.
In the book, you recount just some bizarre things that happened. I hadn't remembered this. one of the princes massacring most of the royal family, and then the civil war which ensued, the Maoist insurgent.
Right. The royal massacre is the flashpoint for many Nepalese because it inflamed the civil war, which had started with the Maoists several years earlier. But the palace massacre, when Crown Prince Dipendra got high and took three guns and killed 14 members of his family in just a few minutes, devastated Nepal, changed the history of the nation and Pasang Lama's life. 150,000 Nepalese were displaced, Nepalese like Pasang.
What are conditions there now in Nepal?
Last time I checked, there was no government. It's in recovery. The civil war has ended, but it's a failed state.
Just a couple minutes left, and I want each of you to maybe just to talk about what you're on to next. Dr. Meyer, more mountaineering?
Certainly more mountaineering. I'm actually hoping to go into the Rowelling Valley late this fall with Searing and try a new route on a 6,000-meter peak. And possibly join him on Everest from the south side in 2013, along with Lhotse next to it. So we'll see. Some smaller projects and outings here this summer in Colorado and Wyoming, Utah, and that's about it.
And Amanda Padawan, what's next for you?
Well, my current obsession is to find Sandy Irvin's body on the Yellow Band of Everest. He was on the 1924 ascent of Everest with George Mallory, and it's presumed that in one of his pockets is a vest pocket Kodak camera with film from that first ascent, which could prove or disprove whether they reached the summit. So if cosmic rays haven't destroyed the film, there should be some very interesting history in his pocket.
Oh, definitely. Well, we're out of time. We have been talking with Amanda Padawan, with Peter Zuckerman, is author of Buried in the Sky, the extraordinary story of the Sherpa climbers on K2's deadliest day. We've also been talking with Dr. Eric Meyer, who was on one of those expeditions on the deadly day and treated some of the survivors as they came down. They, along with Chiring Dorje, who we've been talking about, will be at the Salt Lake City Public Library, 7 o'clock, June 25th. This is in conjunction with King's English Bookshop as part of the Authors Live series. That, again, is June 25th. And thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate you being on with us. And coming up tomorrow, we're going to be talking about immigration. We'll get the reaction from Utah. Residents and officials to President Obama's signed executive order enacting the essentials of the DREAM Act. And we'll also be getting reaction to the special legislative session called by the governor. That's ongoing today. That's coming up tomorrow on Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll explore the music of South Africa, a country that has had a major impact on popular music worldwide. I'm Rosalie Howard.
And I'm Dan Storper. Join us for the music of Miriam Makeba, Johnny Clegg, and many more on South Africa, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.